Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a doctor and public health expert joins the show to answer your questions about COVID-19, the Delta variant, vaccines, and the risks here in Wisconsin. First, Congress created new pandemic unemployment programs last year to deal with big job losses seen in the early days of the outbreak. And those programs were extended in March of this year. Now they're slated to end next Monday nationwide. And those unemployment recipients here in Wisconsin will see their last day of the extended benefits under the program this Saturday. According to projections from the Century Foundation, 7.5 million Americans are expected to lose all their unemployment benefits when the programs end. What does that all mean, then, for people relying on pandemic unemployment coverage? And what changes do unemployment systems need to respond to the next crisis? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been relying on one of these pandemic unemployment programs right now, either the one that pays a little extra each week, $300 extra each week for recipients, the program that extends coverage past normal state limits, or the one that applies to self-employed people? How will the end of those benefits impact you? Do you think it's time for these enhanced unemployment benefits to end now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Bauer is a fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, whose research focuses on safety net policies. She's also affiliated with the Hamilton Project at Brookings. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Lauren, I gave very brief summaries of the different unemployment programs that are expiring in under a week now. Can you spell those out a little more for us? What is out there on the table right now?
Sure. So I think when the pandemic hit, Congress really acted quite quickly to try and help people, workers specifically, right, who were going to lose their jobs through no fault of their own, because this recession was not caused by a problem in the economy. It was caused by a public health crisis. And so they made a couple of different changes, some of which we usually do during recessions and some of which were new for the first time here, to help make families whole. So, you know, normally when we're in a recession, we want people to be able to get extended benefits longer, unemployment benefits longer. And so one of the programs that was started, re-upped, and will be ending this week is a program that lets you stay on unemployment insurance longer. You know, I think the two other pieces that are new for this recession are giving people a top up. So it started as $600 and then became $300 to try and get people closer to, or in some cases over, the wages that they were earning before they lost their jobs. And then finally, you know, not everybody qualifies for unemployment insurance who's a worker. And so a new program, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, PUA, was created to try and provide some insurance to workers who otherwise, you know, weren't paying into the system before and their employer wasn't paying into the system before, like gig workers and the self-employed. And so all three of those programs are ending at the same time nationwide this Saturday, except in those states that chose to end them early.
When the pandemic hit, as you mentioned, a bunch of sudden job losses for a lot of people, big spike in unemployment, unemployment substantially lower now. We're not completely back to normal levels at this point. But given the improvement since then, do you see a need for those programs to go on, or do you feel like this is a good time for them to wrap up?
So I'm not a big fan of dates certain, which is to say that, you know, when Congress reauthorized these programs, they just picked a date, Labor Day, notably, to just end the programs without any understanding at the time or even now what the economy was really going to look like, right? And I think, you know, a little bit ago, before Delta really came back with a roar, you know, the economy was looking like it was getting closer to a self-sustaining recovery on broad strokes. And there were, you know, certain people in the country who were having a lot harder time, like moms who had to caregive, you know, low-income workers of color, people who were competing for the first time with, you know, teenagers in the labor market, and they still needed help, but it seemed like we were in a good place. Now, I think there's a lot of worry about how precarious this economic recovery is because, you know, the economy is not going to get back on track until the virus is under control. And the virus is not under control. That's a real problem when you have deadlines like these that are date certain and not tied to, economics-based triggers.
And that date certain is coming up, as you mentioned, Labor Day. What do you see as the impact of these programs coming to a close for some people? That's going to mean losing benefits completely. For some people, it's going to mean losing the extra $300 a week. What's the impact of all that dropping out at once?
Sure. So some of my colleagues have already started to study this problem, looking at the states who decided to end the program early. And what they found is kind of alarming, but I think we can qualify that. So on the one hand, you know, when these states cut off unemployment benefits before they had to, you know, about a third of their participants lost all of their benefits, right? So we're going from a third to 100. Then, some did find jobs, you know, at a slightly higher rate than in the states that maintain their benefits. But they held off spending because, you know, they lost, you know, hundreds of dollars in unemployment insurance, but they only made $14 more. And so, you know, into that hole, you are actually pulling a ton of money out of the economy. And so I think the things that we're worried about at the household level is if you lost your job and you are still unemployed now, there's a reason. Like, we are not a country that just loves to hang out on unemployment insurance. Like, you have a kid you're taking at home, you're caregiving, you're a single mom, you can't take a job now, or you can't find a job, or you are planning to take a job at the Google campus and then the Google campus closed and now you can't, you know, go work in that cafeteria like you were planning to next month, that we are not going to be providing any insurance protection to people who have been riding this out. But we're also worried about pulling all of that money out of the economy. You know, we've spent a lot of money from unemployment insurance has gone into the economy, and people have been able to maintain their spending. And, you know, I think we're worried that, you know, because this timing is happening at such a precarious point, that pulling those resources, those stimulative dollars out of the economy at a precarious point could snowball into something worse.
Talking to Lauren Bauer from the Brookings Institution about the upcoming end of expanded unemployment benefits, a COVID-19 related relief effort there. It ends on September 6th, a couple days earlier, effectively here in Wisconsin. It ends the extra $300 a week payments, the extended eligibility timelines, and self-employed worker coverage as well. Does that affect you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or are you thinking it is time for these expanded benefits to end? Let us know what you think. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Lauren, you mentioned the thought that some people are not going into the workforce now because they've got this extra $300 a week stay. They've got these longer eligibility timelines. And we've had employer groups in Wisconsin say, hey, we're having trouble hiring people. And this money is helping them at least stay on the sidelines when they could be coming and making money, expanding our economy here in the state. What do you say to those concerns?
There doesn't seem to be any evidence that either the enhanced benefit amount, so that extra $300 or $600, or the fact that, you know, that pandemic unemployment assistance or being able to stay on the program longer is having a meaningful impact on employment nationwide. And, you know, I don't think that there's any specific information about Wisconsin, but, you know, Wisconsin has a lower unemployment rate than the nation by, you know, about 1.5 percentage points and a higher labor force participation rate. And so, you know, just extrapolating from there, I think, you know, what applies at the nation would apply to Wisconsin. These programs are not holding back the economy in Wisconsin. If anything, they're injecting some cash.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi. I guess I kind of want to echo that point is, you know, we're running a business that is hungry right now for workers. We're offering bonus packages, and we offer competitive pay rates and things like that that would probably be very close to what the workers are making now with these enhanced benefits, but it wouldn't be the case if they would have just been on a straight Wisconsin unemployment. And so I see the federal government is propping up the economy through people by just giving this money out, but it is affecting our ability to draw workers in. And until we get this, I don't really see the economy being able to stand on its own at all until we can get workers back into jobs that, whether they were used to or not, you know, they, even if they were just working as a waiter or a waitress or something like that, they're not getting back to these jobs that are open here that really desperately need their help, or even construction work that we're working on that we need people to work at, and we can't get people to go, and we're giving $1,000 bonuses for signing up with us.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. So Mike feeling like he's competing with these enhanced benefits, Lauren, to get people on the job.
So that's really interesting, I think, because as I said, there's no evidence that that is true, because the generosity of, you know, the benefits the people know are ending, right, can't compete with a good and steady job. But I think a lot of workers over the past year have really taken the time to reevaluate, you know, what a safe and proper workplace is. And I think that people are holding out because they don't feel safe. And, you know, they are expecting better pay than what's being offered. You know, the way to attract workers is to raise their wage. And if your wages are pretty close to unemployment insurance, you know, that's on you to raise it to attract those people and to find best match in the market. But as I said, you know, the unemployment rate in Wisconsin is really low. I think, you know, we want to try to get more people off of the sidelines. Those are not people getting unemployment insurance, right? Those are people who have exited the labor market because they're taking care of their kids, or for some other reason, they're not actively searching. And the bigger thing to change here is not about workers who lost their job and taking away the benefits that were insured and they earned, but, you know, drawing more people who are not in the labor force at all off the sidelines.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Lauren Bauer, fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's with us today to talk about pandemic-related unemployment programs set to end this Saturday in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you receive unemployment payments over the course of the pandemic? How did it affect your life? Do you want to see the programs we're talking about extend past this weekend? Looks like that's not going to happen. Or do you think it is time for them to end? Do you have a question about how this works for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about enhanced unemployment benefits created during the pandemic coming to an end. Lauren Bauer stays with us from the Brookings Institution. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to address this notion that, you know, people are staying home because they're receiving an extra $300 a month. With this thought that I'm hoping your guest can address, I mean, I think I'm perceiving reality correctly here when, you know, is that just a shortage of service workers that I personally am experiencing, but just try to make a doctor's appointment. You know, I mean, so many doctors in my town have retired early because of COVID, and surely we don't think that, you know, they are staying home because of an extra $300 a month. That's ridiculous. But I mean, you know, I know lots of people that have left the workforce early due to COVID, and they're white collar professionals. It's just we apply this irrational conclusion, you know, in a prejudicial manner to people who are not quote unquote white collar workers. And I don't understand that. I guess that's just an argument people can make when confronted with this conclusion that people are staying home because of $300 a month.
Laura, thanks for the call. And to clarify, Lauren, I think it's $300 a week, but Laura's point that there may be there are shortages in lots of lines of work, including ones that would make substantially more than that kind of unemployment money.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And I think we're seeing a huge shift here, right? Because for a long time, you know, it is not typical that the service sectors are the sectors that are decimated in recession. And so we've seen the inverse here where people were spending, you know, tons of money on cars. I mean, I had to buy a dryer and a dishwasher during this because, you know, we were using it a lot and they broke, right? People are spending money on durables. And now as we're, you know, somewhat feeling safer and trying to make these appointments with people, we're finding out that that doctor retired or that, you know, dentist, you know, the dental assistant has to watch her kids and all of that's harder. And so, you know, I think we're going to learn a lot over the next couple of months about, you know, what is happening when we really start to reopen, that it's not just about unemployment insurance, which is insurance for workers who lose their job through no fault of their own, with other more fundamental things about this pandemic, about childcare, and about, you know, the aging of the workforce.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Lauren Bauer from the Brookings Institution about the end of pandemic era unemployment insurance programs coming up at the end of this week. Let's go back to your calls now. Paul is on the line in Monona. Paul, hello.
Oh, thank you for having me. I think right now is a great opportunity for people to kind of switch careers. I mean, maybe they're in the service industry. They could find something else, possibly in a factory or a warehouse. I was able to do that, make more money. I don't understand why we'd be giving money to people who choose to be unvaccinated. I mean, I understand some medically can't be vaccinated, but that's a very small number. But we got a lot of people out there who don't want to get vaccinated, and yet we're giving them money. And so, you know, it's a voluntary system. We don't have to give you money. You don't have to get vaccinated. But if we're going to give you money, I think, you know, we should be vaccinating. People should be getting vaccinated. And, you know, I just, there's a lot of people choosing not to work, and it's kind of crazy.
Paul, I wanted to ask, if you're willing to share, what kind of service work did you get out of, and was it just because of the money, or was it something about the service job as well?
Well, I got out of working in bars as a bartender because, well, I mean, you know, everything shut down, and then when, you know, I was looking for jobs, I was able to find you know, jobs in basically in a warehouse making a lot more money. And Epstein didn't kill himself.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call, except for the strange digression at the end there. But Lauren, Paul's point about service sector workers, I know a lot of people, anecdotally at least, getting out of that line of work, looking for more lucrative things, not really attached to vaccination status, these unemployment benefits. Your thoughts on someone he had to say there?
I think that you know, is the trend that we're seeing, certainly on the low wage sector, and we're going to see some productivity enhancements there. But I think we're really in early days here about, you know, how the post COVID economy is going to fundamentally switch. And frankly, I would be very excited to get to the post COVID economy because I'm much more concerned that we're going to be in a perpetual COVID economy because of what your caller was just saying about, you know, vaccination rates not being where they need to be to keep our children safe, much less, you know, the economy.
And Lauren, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on how to do this kind of program, maybe in a future recession or other crisis. You earlier criticized what you call the date certain concept. We're passing this economic program and it's going to end on this date. And I know there are some things like for a lot of years, dairy, there was a counter-cyclical program. It kicks in when the price of milk goes to a certain point. Do you think that's a better strategy for this kind of thing?
I do. And my group at the Brookings Institution, the Hamilton Project, published a book a few years ago that was quite influential called Recession Ready. And what that did was identify a series of indicators that an economy is in the recession and when that happens, what are the kinds of things that we can do to you know, get the economy back on track and provide support to families. And so that includes you know, making sure that we are initiating and ending programs when the economy tells us it's time. And then on unemployment insurance specifically, you know, there are a lot of proposals. I think the most sensible ones are moving to a fully federal system so that states aren't in a position to, you know, end things earlier than they should, and also allows us to not have to do things like give a $600 or a $300 top up when you'd rather give a wage replacement rate. And I think there's another sensible thing here about, you know, what does pandemic unemployment assistance, the, you know, the program for people who aren't normally insured look like under a fundamental reform. And I think it pulls in new workers. You know, we know that when you graduate into a recession, you know, it follows you for a lifetime. And one of the reasons that happens is because you don't have tenure to earn access to the unemployment insurance system. And so, you know, combining new entrants, recent graduates, giving them some money to get on their feet and find a job with, you know, additional insurance coverage for gig workers and part-time workers to complement the traditional system. I think that is sort of the set of things that we'd want to do that would improve the system in normal times and help us respond better to a recession next time.
Lauren, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
That was Lauren Bauer. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institution focusing on safety net policies. She joined us today to talk about how the millions still relying on extended unemployment benefits will be affected by the end of these pandemic-related unemployment programs that happens this Saturday in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the latest COVID news, the numbers, the Delta variant, and vaccines, and we'll take your questions with a doctor who's also a public health expert. You can get started right now. Share your question over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Get a head start. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, get the latest installment in an ongoing series of conversations about health for different age groups. This time, the focus is on healthy living in our 60s. That might be you, might be somebody you know. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now we're looking at the latest COVID news. A number of states around the country are reaching intensive care unit capacity as the Delta variant continues to spread, putting the U.S. near hospitalization numbers that hadn't been seen since the peak in January of this year. But it's not all bad news. The FDA granted full approval to the Pfizer vaccine last week. Since then, there's been a 17% increase in the average number of Americans getting their first shot each week. We're talking about the pandemic, where we're at today, what the future might hold, and we can answer some of your questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is on your mind? What are you wondering about when it comes to COVID-19? Vaccines, the possibility of booster shots, mask wearing. Do you have kids under 12? What do you want to know about kids and COVID? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Patrick Remington is an expert in public health and preventive medicine and an emeritus professor at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back, Rob.
We've talked a lot since early last year about COVID-19 and its progression. What do you have your eye on the most right now, Dr. Remington?
Well, I think, first of all, looking back, much of what has happened has been predictable and preventable. We knew that this virus had the potential to mutate. It does so every time it replicates. Within 2 or 3 weeks, you might have a new variant. And we just know from basic virology or biology that over time, these mutations might find one that is more competitive, better at infecting people. And so it will select out. And that's what happened. The Delta variant emerged in England and basically has become the predominant strain. So we knew that. We also knew a lot about vaccines. We knew that they provided tremendous protection for individuals. But we also knew that vaccines aren't perfect. They don't last forever. So we suspected that over time, there might be the need to use a booster. So I think one of the things is just to go back and realize that we saw much of this coming. It might not have been talked about in the press or, in the public. But a lot of this was certainly predictable and some of it preventable if we'd just done a better job as a society at doing safe practices and getting everyone vaccinated.
Looking at Florida now, one of our hot spots in the country, a handful of southern states seeing high vaccination numbers. And hear me out here. I look at last year, Florida peaked a couple months before Wisconsin did. Right now, Florida has vaccination rates in the ballpark of Wisconsin and patchy. Some counties much higher vaccination rates, some counties lower. That makes me wonder if we should be worried that come late October, we have the risk at least of being a Midwestern hotspot for the illness. What are your thoughts? What would it take to prevent that?
Well, certainly remember last year, the Midwest was a hotspot. We were wondering why beginning in September and then certainly through November when our cases peaked. We thought it was a combination of a number of things. Going indoors, going back to school, and obviously not having the benefit of a vaccine. So that could certainly happen again. Although we are in a different place, we have now over half of the population in Wisconsin is fully vaccinated. That's the glass half full. But we still have many people who are unvaccinated, and that's the empty half of the glass. So I think there's a great opportunity that as FDA has approved the Pfizer vaccine, that may assure people that this is certainly safe and effective, and we may move that needle a bit more. And then unfortunately, with so many people getting infected, and maybe three times as many people have been infected and have not been diagnosed, we are getting to a point where we have lots of people either vaccinated or having had illness. So I think we're in a different place than we were a year ago. But you always worry that if another state is struggling, that could just portend our future in a couple of months.
I want to focus on some of the good news. It seems like vaccines are still very effective. Even with the Delta variant out there, the hospitalization numbers, correct me if I'm wrong, overwhelmingly people who are unvaccinated. Same with fatalities from COVID-19, if I'm not mistaken. What do we know at this point about the effectiveness of the vaccines?
Well, the vaccine is incredibly effective. It is most effective in preventing serious illness. Our immune system is very complex. In fact, I've had to get out my immunology book from a few years ago to sort of study again how the immune system works. We have our frontline defenses, antibodies in our nasal secretions and in our saliva. And those frontline antibodies will find viruses like SARS-CoV-2 and bind it and not allow us to get infected. But it's pretty easy to overwhelm those antibodies. And then the virus gets inside our body. Well, we have circulating antibodies in our bloodstream, and those will bind the antibody. But the Delta variant divides very, very rapidly. So it can even overwhelm those. And fortunately, there's a third line of defense, which is our T cell. These are called cell mediated immunity. It lives in a bone marrow and organs. And those cells their immunity lasts a long time. And, you know, they go to work and fight the infection and prevent us from getting really sick. So when you get vaccinated, you have good protection sort of up in the front lines, circulating in the bloodstream, but also that deep-seated immunity. And that last one is what keeps us from getting very sick. We may get infected. We may actually infect others, but we're much less likely to get very sick if you've been vaccinated.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, expert in public health and preventive medicine, emeritus professor at UW-Madison's Department of Population Health Sciences, looking at the latest COVID-19 news, the Delta variant, vaccination rates, vaccination efforts, and more. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page what is on your mind. Let's go to a caller now. Bill is with us in Bruce. Bill, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
I've had a fair amount of diversity training with the past jobs I've had, and I'm really curious to know why there's nothing being covered about the racism, bigotry of the non-vaccinated. I mean, if we treated blacks, Latinos, Native Americans the way we're treating the unvaccinated right now, there'd be class action lawsuits, politicians hopping on board to see how many brownie points they could make, but there's absolutely nothing that's being said about it.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Of course, vaccination status isn't a race, Dr. Remington, but Bill, I think leads to an interesting question about, you know, what is the right way to reach out to people who aren't vaccinated to try to convince them, and sometimes yelling at people doesn't get the result you want. What do you think, Dr. Remington?
Well, it's a good point. Yes, from the perspective of a decision that one makes, that's not in a way a protected class like someone's race or gender. So I think, but that being said, that's not a license to really have conflict within communities or even within families. I think if people choose not to be vaccinated, they need to understand that there's two types of risk. One is the risk to yourself, and you certainly have the ability to make that decision. And we allow people to drink themselves into a stupor in their home. We allow people to smoke cigarettes in their home. But we draw the line when that behavior harms others. So we don't let people drink and drive, or we arrest them if they get caught. We don't allow people to smoke cigarettes in airplanes anymore, or in daycare centers, or in restaurants, because that's an individual decision that harms others. So I think that's the difficult thing here, that many people who've chosen not to be vaccinated feel that they have the right to do that because they can take a risk, and that's certainly their a choice to do that. But where it crosses the line is if that choice harms others, if their choice not to be vaccinated means they get infected and infect others, family members, or other people they run into, then that's a choice that really has harmed others. And that's why we have public health rules and laws to encourage or sometimes make it a law that people have to they cannot drink and drive. You can't smoke here, because those are individual behaviors that don't just affect you. They harm others.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, expert in public health and preventive medicine, emeritus professor at UW-Madison. Talk to us about COVID and the latest news, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the Delta variant, the future of the pandemic? Are you someone who's immunocompromised? What are your thoughts on a possible booster vaccination shot? Do you have kids 12 and or under 12 who can't get vaccinated yet? What kind of precautions are you taking, or are you trying to figure out what kind of precautions to take? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now about the latest COVID news and your questions with Dr. Patrick Remington. He's an emeritus professor at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what you're seeing in the news about COVID-19, about the precautions that are being taken? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Owen is with us in De Pere. Owen, hello.
Good afternoon, and thank you. I was calling to see if there is a difference in immunity between having the COVID-19 and not having the COVID-19, but having the vaccine.
Great question, Owen, and I think, Dr. Remington, one that a lot of researchers are looking at very closely, immunity from having COVID-19 versus from having just the vaccine.
Yeah, the general findings today is that the vaccine provides a better level of immunity, at least in the short run, because we basically control the exposure, the stimulation of the our immune system. The information that we have on the efficacy of the vaccine has been determined through a clinical trial, randomizing people to get a vaccine and not. And that's the best kind of science. We can say with very good certainty when we see differences in disease rates in a vaccine trial that we know that that's due to the vaccine. So we really have good evidence on vaccine efficacy. The problem with studies that look at the efficacy of being getting COVID versus not is there are a lot of other factors that differ between people who happen to get COVID and people who don't. That's not a randomized experiment. That's something that happens by people's choice, by their other behaviors. So it could be those other factors that affect the difference between somebody who's gotten the disease and somebody who hasn't. So, but I think the best evidence is that not to focus on the vaccine or the efficacy of the vaccine versus natural illness, is to focus on the consequences. The vaccine is extremely safe, one of the safest vaccines ever produced. Hundreds of millions of doses have been administered with no deaths that I've I read just yesterday that there have been no deaths related and very few complications. That's not the case with people who get sick. We know that we're at 600,000, more than a half a million people have died, maybe 15% higher death rate in this year from this pandemic. So if you're going to get, if you're looking for immunity, certainly don't take the path of natural disease. That comes with serious risks. The vaccine is a much better way to get your immunity.
Owen, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mary joins us now in Pewaukee. Mary, hello.
Hi. Yes, thanks for taking my call. And my grandson is 14 years old, and I think you basically just answered it, which is what I thought, where he has said in the past that he doesn't want to get it. There was some symptom of the vaccination that he was worried about. And my feeling is, the COVID, if you get it health-wise, or, even if you don't die from it, the symptoms could be lifelong. But he had mentioned something about young boys and their back, their BACK, their back. And I never heard of anything like this. Have you heard of anything that he might be referring to so I can kind of push him towards getting that vaccination to keep him safe?
Mary, thanks for the call. Any particular side effects from the vaccine that's being researched for younger boys in this case? And then can you stack up concerns about that versus the risks of COVID, Dr. Remington?
Well, again, I haven't studied really the specific potential for vaccine side effects in younger mm-hmm. people. I do know that the vaccine trials have shown that vaccines are not safe and effective in children 12 to 17 years of age. So if there are any risks, those risks are very small. And we know the illness carries a serious risk. Again, one of the things that people point out is that kids are less likely to get seriously ill, which is true. But what does it mean to be less likely? Is it 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000? The problem is that when you take that very low risk and multiply it by the entire population of young people in the state or in the country, you come up with a lot of people, a lot of kids who will get really sick and some of whom will die. So we have to be really careful with these statements that it's not very dangerous or the risk is very low when potentially the entire population right now, again, no, children under the age of 12 don't have the opportunity to be vaccinated. So we have to protect them the best we can until such a time as we have a vaccine.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mary, we'll go now to Lou in northern Wisconsin. Lou, hello.
Hey, good afternoon. Actually, two things. While you were talking, it brought up another point that we do not know the long term of the vaccines. So there is hesitancy regarding getting the vaccine with many people regarding that, the long term. And second of all, I would like to know why physicians are not pushing keeping the body healthy through food choices and activity. I see a lot of people who are at the store and they've got carts of sugar and fat, and it's obvious they don't exercise, but yet they want this magic bullet. They want a magic wand to make everything go away and be perfect, and they don't have to work for it. So this is why I would like physicians to be tough on their patients.
Lou, you know? Thanks for the call. Dr. Remington, you and I have talked for years about you wanting people to have better nutrition and get activity. That said, that alone is not a magic bullet against COVID, right?
Well, it's not, but I would agree with the caller. I mean, I don't think this is an either-or proposition. Mm-hmm. I think every physician would want to advise their patient to be healthy, to eat right, to exercise, and that is hard in today's society. So certainly promote healthy lifestyles. I don't think we need to pit sort of healthy living and wellness against the vaccines. In fact, they go together very well. If you engage in healthy lifestyle and you maintain good body weight and don't smoke, you now are in a low risk category. But if you add a vaccine to that, one that, again, that has been shown to be extremely safe, and although yes, we have not studied this vaccine for decades, but as time goes on, every day that goes on where we don't see an increase in any long-term adverse effects of that vaccine is more evidence that it's safe and effective. That cannot be said for the disease. I can't emphasize that enough. This disease, each day, just today, I read yet another concern about long-term complications of COVID infection. So it's not a question of is the vaccine safe or not. It's a question, is the vaccine a better choice than being at risk of getting the illness? And it is absolutely the safer, healthier choice.
Thanks for that call. In our last few minutes, Dr. Remington, some good news. Apparently, as I said at the beginning, vaccination rates seem to be going up again after lagging for some months. Are you encouraged by that just in our last half a minute or so?
Well, I am encouraged. I think, again, I completely understand people's hesitancy and concern about putting a needle in your arm and the biology of RNA vaccines and adenovirus agents that help us get immunity. But rely on the fact that health experts around the world have studied this and know that this is a safe and effective vaccine. And don't just do it for yourself. This is one where getting vaccinated will help you help others. It'll protect the health of others, protect the health of the community. So I think it's the best, single best thing we can do today is just get your vaccine.
Dr. Remington, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Dr. Patrick Remington is an expert in public health and preventive medicine and an emeritus professor at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences. He joined us today for a look at some of the latest COVID-19 news related to the Delta variant, the vaccines, and more, and to help answer some of your questions along the way. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Paralympic Games are in high gear in Tokyo this week. We'll get the latest on the games, the events there, the history of adaptive sports and how they brought us to today, and check out Wisconsin's strong presence on the U.S. team. Plus, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national news, including the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the arrival of special visa holders here in the U.S. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. It's September Eve, and among other things, that means that fall leaves are just around the corner, and there's good news. A meteorologist quoted in the Washington Post says this should be a great year for fall foliage in states including Colorado, Michigan, and, yes, Wisconsin. If you're planning a hike or road trip built around leaves, check out two great resources, the Wisconsin Fall Foliage Map at the Travel Wisconsin website, or if you're looking outside the state, the website SmokyMountains.com has a nationwide interactive leaf map, not just for the Smoky Mountains. Here on Central Time, producer Bill Martins is our big foliage fan, and he takes some real pretty pictures, too. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Robin. Tomorrow is the first day of meteorological fall.
Excellent. Okay, now where you love going out and seeing leaves. What have been some of your favorite places to go for a hike or drive?
So last year I went up to northern Wisconsin. I went to Timms Hill, the highest geographical point in the state, and I got there right at peak color time. It was brilliant, breathtaking views, lots of color. And then on the way back to Madison, I swung by Rib Mountain State Park and got some great views of colors over the city of Wausau as well. It was a great day.
One quick tip for taking pictures of those leaves, Bill.
A polarizing filter, if you have one, you can really make those colors pop.
Well, your pictures work, so I'll take your word for it. Bill, thanks. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.